There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome to the 45th podcast. It's me, Susan Simpson, and I'm here with Siraj Hashmi to talk about all things sports and Ukraine this week. Siraj, welcome back.
Thank you for having me on, Susan.
Yeah, well, we figured last week we needed a subject matter expert to help us with the current goings on in the world.
Oh, yeah, it's quite nutty, and I never thought I'd find myself in the position where I can combine two of my favorite passions into one gigantic week of controversy.
Yeah, and I take it all back, making fun of you a couple weeks ago about your loss of your person, whoever got traded away.
It's okay. It was Isaiah Thomas for Kyrie Irving, but I'll just get right into it. So over the weekend, President Donald Trump, he did the unthinkable. He united rivals across the sports world against him and got people to care about what the opinions of many athletes were. On Friday, in a campaign rally for Senator Luther Strange, Republican from Alabama.
Who lost, by the way.
Who just lost on Tuesday night to Judge Roy Moore in a Republican primary runoff.
Which is a tiny bit funny because of the Trump thing, but also horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into it because I definitely have some thoughts on that. But Trump addressed the ongoing protests where some NFL players began using the national anthem as a time to stage a protest by taking a knee. You know, some have locked arms with other teammates. Others have held like the Black Power fist up in the air. And it was all inspired by former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who back in 2016 initially was seen on the sideline sitting and then started kneeling. But this is a quote from Trump. There's a direct quote that he said in Huntsville, Alabama that night.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired. You know, some owner's going to do that. He's going to say, that guy that disrespects our flag, he's fired. And that owner, they don't know it. They don't know it. They're friends of mine, many of them. They don't know it. They'll be the most popular person for a week. They'll be the most popular person in this country because that's a total disrespect of our heritage. That's a total disrespect of everything that we stand for, okay? Everything that we stand for.
And on Saturday, President Trump further clarified on Twitter, quote, if a player wants the privilege of making millions of dollars in the NFL or other leagues, he or she should not be allowed to disrespect our great American flag or country and should stand for the national anthem. If not, you're fired. And he put "you're fired" in all caps. Find something else to do, end quote. Of course, there are so many things going on, but let me just try to break it down as succinctly as I can. So following those statements, a number of NFL teams and players continue to stage protests, but it kind of spread throughout the entire league. So you saw teams like the Pittsburgh Steelers, Seattle Seahawks, and Tennessee Titans. They skipped the national anthem altogether. And then you had other teams, say like on the New England Patriots, Cleveland Browns, Indianapolis Colts, et cetera, et cetera. You had a number of players take knees, or you had the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars, Shad Khan, actually lock arms with his players in the first game of that day. And that was the reason it was the first game of the day. It was actually in London, so it was 9 a.m.
Okay, so why was it in London, by the way? I've been wondering that.
Okay, yeah, so that was big. And it's huge when you consider the fact that that game is being played in London, and it looks rather strange, I'm sure, to a lot of Londoners that This controversy is happening during an international game, and we just look as divided as ever.
But, like, why was there a game in England?
Oh, so the NFL has this deal set up since it's been happening since 2008, 2009, where there'll be a random selection of teams that go over to play in London to kind of like broaden the appeal of the NFL, the international appeal. So it's kind of like when you see during the summer some, you know, Premier League or Spanish League clubs in soccer, they'll come to the U.S. for like they'll play a friendly match or what they call an exhibition. They call it a friendly, but it's
you
just
can't really
so, like,
do friendlies though with the English American
right,
football team,
right? So like, and I mean, they call it friendly. Obviously, it's not very friendly, but it's meant to be just like a way to like broaden the fan appeal in the United States and in other parts of the world. They do it in Asia, and it's great. It's great for, you know, fans like me. I'm a fan of Arsenal. They're a club in London, and they came to the United States a few years ago. I unfortunately did not get a chance to go to a game, but if I had the money, I totally would. So getting back into the story, you know, a lot of players protested, and I don't think Donald Trump, he went for maybe four straight days of tweeting about it. I'm not sure if I saw one from him on Wednesday, and Tuesday was the last time that he tweeted about it. But essentially, the crux of the issue is that if you take a knee during the national anthem, you're disrespecting the flag, and you're basically sullying the memory of all the men and women who fought and died or sacrificed to protect the freedoms that we so cherish.
Because we're now a country, apparently, where our flag is synonymous with our military.
Right, and that's the, I think, in fault of the NFL, which has actually, you know, kind of made that connection between the national anthem, the flag, and the military during NFL games, because that's the time when they actually salute any member of the military.
It wasn't that thing where, like, the DOD was, like, paying?
Right. So I think it was somewhere. I think it was somewhere around $15 million that they were paying the NFL to continue these ceremonies. Can't remember the exact figure, but I believe it was revealed in 2015 that the DOD was paying money to the NFL to have this done. So now you're hearing all these type of things from, like, people, you know, members of Congress. So you have the president talking about, you know, pulling all taxpayer funds from, you know, paying for stadiums or subsidies towards the NFL in any way.
I'm cool with that.
I mean, I'm sure most people are. I for one, as a taxpayer, I hate paying for stadiums when billionaires can easily pay for them themselves. Right now, and this is an interesting thing because, you know, the original Kaepernick protest, he did it to raise awareness to end police brutality. That was one. And then the second one was to reform the criminal justice system. Those are both, you know, virtuous causes. I think everyone can agree that.
They're not just virtuous. They're really important causes that affect a lot of players deeply and personally. In some of the cases, some of the kneelers.
They should be on the top of everyone's priority list in terms of fixing. He was immediately criticized for being anti-American. And the take a knee protest now kind of being adopted by most, a lot of NFL players, owners, and coaches has somehow seemed to be a show of unity against Donald Trump than it is really about being against or being for those original two things that Kaepernick protested.
So I don't agree with you there. I think that there is sort of two things going on. I think the unity displays are against Trump, but most of the players didn't kneel. It was still, I don't know how many players there are altogether. I'm making this up, but it seemed like maybe 1 in 10 kneeled, but just about everyone was locking arms in solidarity. Now that, I think there's two kind of, it's not even a protest really, it's just a sign that, you know what, this is our private enterprise, the president can't dictate how we're going to do it. But the kneeling, I think that is still very much about what Kaepernick did it for in the beginning. And there was a study came out today that said most people could recognize what the protests were about, as we about police brutality and racial inequality and justice system. And I think only 12% thought it was actually a protest against, like, America or the flag.
I had not seen that study yet.
So most people, yeah, do recognize what it's about. And I think that's possibly why it's been such an effective wedge issue. It's because they know it's about police brutality and violence from the police and fatal shootings against Black Americans. And that's why it is so divisive. It's not just about the protests and when it is. It's about what the cause is, too.
Right. And I think some of it, though, was lost over the weekend. And the NFL is already trying to basically market and campaign off of it.
I missed that.
Yeah, that's the thing, is that if the NFL didn't step in and start doing this, we probably would not be in this position where I would be saying that the cause is being lost.
Well, it's lost on Trump. I'm not sure if that's lost on the players, but if the NFL is trying to market this thing, I'm not surprised.
I think, unfortunately for the cause, it's largely become an anti-Trump gesture. I mean, if you just look at what happened at Georgetown University Law Center when Attorney General Jeff Sessions spoke, you had a protest happening outside, and then you had the faculty from the law school arrive, and the first thing they did was take a knee. Sure, you can make the argument that it was against police. They want to stop.
Well, it's Sessions, so actually it kind of fits.
Yeah, but it's now being adopted, and the reason why I think the reason why it was so important to begin with was that it was happening during the national anthem. Now, if you take away the national anthem, does the take a knee still have the meaning of wanting to change the criminal justice system and ending police brutality, or is it more against Trump?
I think it's important for anyone who's engaging that kind of protest to vocalize what they're doing and why.
Absolutely.
At the same time, it's hard to see what Trump really is kind of openly aligning himself here with police brutality and a very session style justice.
So he said in his own statements when he was addressing, was it the NYPD back a few months ago? He's like, don't be afraid to rough him up a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, they are closely aligned. And just look at how Trump reacted to fucking Nazis protesting about Confederate war statues compared to politely taking a knee during the national anthem to protest like a huge civil injustice issue.
Right. No, I'm totally with you on that. I mean, it's the level of passion that he has for condemning the NFL protesters far exceeds his level of passion in condemning white supremacists and neo-Nazis who marched in Charlottesville. That is definitely concerning. And I think you can make the case that if you happen to be one of those people who believe it's a disrespectful gesture to take a knee during the national anthem, I mean, there are plenty of points to be made. I think tying in the whole Trump aspect almost worsens the argument, because it sounds like, you know, up until that point, no one cared. And then once Trump weighed in on it, now all of a sudden everybody cares.
But that's kind of how the president worked. I mean, Kaepernick couldn't. I mean, the president has made it his issue. He's done this, and people can't ignore that. And also, so what's your opinion? I don't know anything about it, but Kaepernick, like, why is he not employed? Is it at all because of his playing, or is it because?
I think it's a combination of both. I think I'm not going to get into too many specifics on his playing style, but there is a particular way in which he plays called the pro read option. And defenses were just getting better at defending it, and he never really had as strong of an arm in order to carry a team. So, yeah, I can understand him being a backup, and that's fine. One of the things that he did, though, is he opted out of his contract because he had one more year to go. I think he wanted to test the waters to see if his protests were if he was going to be rewarded or not for his protests by going through free agency. And there were a number of teams who were interested in signing him. The Seattle Seahawks were rumored to be one. And they're one of the most progressive teams in the league, because they have guys like Michael Bennett, who is he's been very active and vocal on his politics. And he actually was held up at gunpoint by police in Las Vegas not too long ago. So that was just a weird situation and tangential to the conversation, but I just want to mention that.
Yeah, I've only seen it seems like more is coming out about it, but the whole thing seems weird.
Yeah, but we can get into that another time. But getting back to the focus, I mean, the Baltimore Ravens are considering bringing him on. And then Kaepernick's girlfriend, Nessa, basically tagged Ray Lewis, who was a former Ravens middle linebacker, legendary player, and basically... So he was trying to make an analogy between Ray Lewis and the owner of the Ravens, who is a white man, and Samuel L. Jackson and Leonardo DiCaprio in Django Unchained. And if you haven't seen Django Unchained, you would know that Samuel L. Jackson is basically the house slave in that movie to Leonardo DiCaprio. So it was kind of saying he was a house N-word. She was saying that he was a house N-word. And then it came out later that Ray Lewis saw that tweet and basically nixed Kaepernick getting signed.
Football drama.
Yeah, and using that as a reason why he didn't get signed. So, you know, it's a combination of his activism and his playing style. If I had to say that it had to do about race, I have nothing really to go off of, unless you want to just point at his protest and make it about race, then fine, you can make that argument. But
it's sort of twined. I'm not sure how you even like disentangle.
I understand, but you know, there are plenty of players who are active in the social justice movement who are still playing, and they may have opinions even stronger than Kaepernick. So I think it's a combination of a number of things for him.
So that's why the football players are doing what they're doing. But as for Trump himself, I mean, he is really, really doubling down on this thing. Like, he doesn't have a big attention span, but he is all about this one. Apparently, he's, like, telling his aides, like, he's, like, happy to be going to the culture war on behalf of his base.
It's hurting him in the long run. I mean, just in the last few days, we saw the Graham Cassidy bill fail. And I think he went to Indianapolis on Wednesday saying incorrectly that he has the votes on health care when they really didn't.
They don't.
And, you know, it's not really doing his agenda any favors when he's going on these culture wars. Of course, it's great press. I mean, think about all the things that have been written about this. But when it comes to things like reforming health care in the way that Trump envisions it, he's not doing himself or the Republicans any favor. In fact, I think I hate to go to my, you know, Trump is playing the long game or the long con, but basically, by setting up this failure for the Republicans, he's further getting more people to primary GOP establishment figures and maybe even putting his trust in the Democrats to show how weak the GOP establishment is. And he just saw it with Roy Moore beating Luther Strange on
Yeah. But Roy Moore is a sign that Trumpism is not all about Trump. It's independent of him. It's a thing of the force in our politics that has to be reckoned with. And it's not... Trump's just its nastiest, brutalist form.
Hi, listeners. I've got a question for you. How often do you think about socks? Maybe when it gets colder, you start thinking about them a little bit more. But even then, if you're like me, you don't put in a whole lot of thought. I mean, socks are socks, right? Well, that's what I used to think until I recently discovered socks that changed the way I'll think about socks forever. They're called Bombas. These might be the most comfortable socks in the history of feet, and that is quite a long history. Now, I just got back from a three-day weekend in Aspen, Colorado. I'm back in DC where it's warmer, but up in Aspen, it felt like winter already, and these socks were amazing. They kept me warm and cozy without making me all uncomfortable and sweaty, and here's the amazing thing. They're made from premium cotton, so they stay warm in the winter, but cool in the summer, so I actually wore them all the way back to DC. And they've got all kinds of styles, tons of colors, patterns, lengths. They look great in the gym, at the office, out of town. You can wear them with your boots, with your shoes, your dress shoes, and your sneakers. They've got every style covered. And for every Bombas purchase that you make, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need. So you can keep cool, keep comfortable, and keep contributing with the best socks, again, maybe in the history of feet. Now, right now, you buy one pair or four at bombas.com/45th today, and you get 20% off your first purchase. That's right. It's Bombas, bombas.com/45th for 20% off. Don't miss out on this great deal. Stock up today for the winter. Go to bombas.com/45th.
Yeah, let's take a break from the sports for a minute because I really want to talk about this Judge Roy Moore. Most likely going to be the senator from Alabama replacing Luther Strange, who replaced Jeff Sessions. What are your thoughts on, you know, surging in the political landscape and possibly being Jeff Sessions 2.0?
You know, I hate Sessions. I think he is an abomination in this country, and I would not even insult him by calling him. Roy Moore is a worse beast by far. Jeff Sessions, for all of his many flaws, isn't what that guy is.
So what is it that really stands out to you about Roy Moore that...
Repeatedly refusing to like enforce the law. That sounds like a pretty big problem for a senator to have, or a judge.
Roy Moore, I don't know that much about the guy, to be honest with you.
He wants to criminalize homosexuality.
I did hear about that. I mean, I remember reading, I actually pulled up a story earlier today and saw that he He wrote about Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota, first Muslim congressman to ever be elected to Congress, who was elected in 2006. And if you recall, in 2006, that was when the Democrats retained control of the House and Nancy Pelosi became Speaker of the House. But Roy Moore wrote that Keith Ellison could not effectively serve in Congress because he would be placing his hand on a Quran during the oath of office and that he'd be swearing an oath under Allah, which is the Arabic word for God, rather than the Judeo-Christian God that he envisioned, not understanding that Muslims believe in the same God that the Abrahamic God, the same God that Jews and Christians believe in. But effectively, he was saying that Keith Ellison can't serve in Congress because he's a Muslim, and being Muslim is diametrically opposed to being an American. And just so our audience knows, I am a Muslim, I am an American. That is false. You can be a proud Muslim and a proud American and maintain your values in the Constitution and your personal values of, you know, how you want to practice your faith, not having and I know it always gets to the idea of Sharia law superimposing the Constitution. That's not what Muslims want.
He's convinced that, like, I think it's like Indiana or something is run by Sharia law right now.
Yeah, that was another thing that he said, that there are communities in Illinois without any
Illinois.
That were under Sharia law, and that's frankly untrue. There are no communities, to my knowledge, that are under Sharia law. If there are, that would be certainly surprising. And if there are communities that want to be under Sharia law, I can just like point to a spot and on the map by spinning the globe and just point to like Maumee, Ohio, where my parents are from. And then bam, all of a sudden that community is under Sharia. That was a joke, guys. I'm bad at making jokes.
I mean, the irony, of course, is like the laws they want to enact are like take away reproductive freedoms, take away like anything that they consider un-Christian. And they're all panicked about the Sharia law thing. And it's also, look at who was supporting Roy Moore, despite the fact Trump was supporting Strange. Like, basically all the MAGAs were all behind him.
Yeah, it's Steve Bannon, Ben Carson, Sarah Palin. I can't think of anybody else from his administration.
Nigel Farage.
Oh, yeah, Nigel Farage. So basically every MAGA.
Gorka.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much all the big names right there.
Yeah, and it's just these... All this stuff bubbling to the surface now. It's always been there in American politics, obviously, but it's so overt now. Like, I mean, obviously it was a Strange rally and not Roy Moore, but when he was going on his NFL rant, Trump said something that kind of gave the game away in some respects. So he started talking about the referees at NFL games, and he's like, oh, they're all proud and, like, calling all these, like, flags, and their wives at home are sitting home and proud of them, and they're ruining the sport. And it's like this projection of like fear of being emasculated by a woman or something, like in the context of an NFL referee calling a foul. But he's like ranting about the NFL. He's like, yeah, that referee is going to call all those fouls and all those hits. And he's complaining, obviously, that they shouldn't be calling hits because the game should be rougher and get more brain dementia. And he goes to, and the wife is sitting at home watching on TV and so proud of him, as if that's like the thing to fear, like this emasculation of the American male by women at home.
Wow. Well, I have to look at that before I can comment on it. I mean, the game, I played football when I was younger. I got plenty of concussions. You know, I would not let my children play football purely based on CTE. I love basketball, so I'm going to teach them how to play basketball and get really good at it. Plus, I'm tall, so I'm hoping my genes can pass on, that they can
and
be tall too.
And it's way safer.
And that's true. Yeah, it's way safer. Plus, you know, ball don't lie, so therefore they won't lie. So let's move on. Let's talk about another story that happened over the last few days featuring our favorite celebrity couple, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, first daughter.
Javanka,
as they're known. So let's start off with the story from Politico focusing on Jared Kushner. So I'll just read off a little bit. Presidential son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner has corresponded with other administration officials about White House matters through a private email account set up during the transition last December, part of a larger pattern of Trump administration aides using personal email accounts for government business. Kushner uses his private account alongside his official White House email account, sometimes trading emails with senior White House officials, outside advisors, and others out about media coverage, event planning, and other subjects, according to four people familiar with the correspondence. And then Ivanka also seemed to be using personal email to communicate with government officials after her father took office, according to a FOIA request reported by Newsweek.
Apparently six people in all, not just Jared and Ivanka, but like four, at least four other.
So the document showed that on February 28th, Trump, identifying herself as Ivanka Kushner, emailed Linda McMahon, who is the U.S. Small Business Administrator, from a personal domain. And she was also operating inside the White House in a non-official capacity. So she wrote that she wanted McMahon's agency and her staff to explore opportunities to collaborate on issues related to women entrepreneurship. And then she copied several government email addresses to Dina Powell and Julie Radford. So now that we know this, how does this tie into what we knew over the last year and a half, 2 years, with respect to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who was repeatedly dogged for her use of personal email?
It shows that the current people in the White House are a bunch of dumbass hypocrites who are too stupid to do anything right. Like, seriously, all you have to do is not have a private email address at this point. Like, you can't do it. Like, all other arguments aside, they have to know that they, like, that, well, it's either stupidity or a complete disregard for anything involving transparency or honesty in office.
But is it the same thing, though, because
we don't know yet, because again, it's private, and apparently the attorneys haven't even seen it all. Based on, because she's not the email prankster.
Yes, I'm familiar. there have been a number of email pranksters, unless there's only been one who's been doing it very well.
I think it actually is one. Some dude on Twitter. I was looking at him.
Yeah, I think I direct messaged him, and I just said, "You got some real chutzpah." And he's like, he seems to not even care. I think he's based in the UK and he just got bored and so he just started doing this.
Let's invite him on the show.
Oh God.
He's doing a good job of it though. He also doesn't like make it secret. Like he's doing these prank emails, like if anyone took a half second to check, they'd see it's fake. He's not trying to spoof anything. He's not trying to, like, he has ridiculous domain names he's using. But on the other hand, the reason why he could have gotten away with this against so many people in the White House is that they're all using their stupid private emails. So they're used to seeing strange emails come in from people they know.
I guess that's true. I mean, there is one thing that, I mean, obviously we know more about Hillary Clinton's private email server and the fact that she deleted 33,000 emails. I have no idea if Kushner and Ivanka deleted emails on their personal email. There are definitely some things that are concerning. I don't think it's nearly as bad as Hillary Clinton, but it certainly doesn't look good.
Okay, so there's a whole lot going on there with this, but like the issue, of course, is like private versus public. And I saw some defenses of what Kushner's doing, saying he has a public account and a private one. Well, that's kind of, I mean, I don't see how that makes it necessarily better as opposed to having all in one account. There's no question of like putting some stuff someplace, some stuff in another. I mean, there's problems all around. And of course, like God knows it's all an overhyped disaster, but surely people feel some sympathy to Hillary Clinton for wanting to be able to check her email or her smartphone.
Well, I don't even fully know.
That's a big reason why it happened. Because the way the State Department was set up, its IT was like 20 years out of date.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if this really vindicates Hillary Clinton. It probably just isn't a sign that more people just disregard the laws of the U.S. government in terms of using private email.
But it's not even like a clearly defined law area. One, they all do it. Like,
yeah, that's what I'm saying. Rampant. Is that they just seem to, everyone seems to be doing it and they just don't care. Or,
and they only pinned it on Hillary because remarkably, that was like the only scandal that could actually get on her, which kind of shows a lot about how she was actually running things. If that's the worst they could find.
Oh no, she killed all those people.
Yes, personally.
Was it Vince Foster? And she definitely had that child sex ring at
oh God, the pizza thing. I want to go to that pizza shop just to like show some support.
So let's move on, because I want to talk about, before we get into Paul Manafort, what's going on in Puerto Rico. So Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands about 2 weeks ago, a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. and, you know, caused destruction across the entire island. Most of the island still is without power. They don't have cell service. Just an all-around, like, disaster. And what's interesting was what we saw take place over the weekend from a number of people, at least in the media and some on the left, who have kind of been trying to suggest that this was like Trump's Katrina. So if you think about Hurricane Katrina and the slow response that we saw from then President George W. Bush, you know, a lot of people seem to think that now, because Trump isn't tweeting about it, that somehow Puerto Rico is not getting help. However, on Friday and over the weekend, it was reported that over 10,000 federal employees went down to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, as well as 700 FEMA employees. And the reason why things have not progressed as far as they have is because there's just so much devastation. As there's most of the infrastructure has been damaged in both islands, that they haven't been able to just access the entire island. And so that's where you're kind of like getting you're starting to get a lot of friction in terms of seeing a full ramped up recovery.
Yeah, the response has been delayed, though. I mean, also the devastation is horrific and on a scale probably, I mean, it looks like at the end of the day, it's going to be much worse than Katrina in terms of infrastructure destruction.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just trying to remember in my head the timetable in terms of when the hurricane happened and when, the federal employees started going down there.
The response has been slow. There were other options they could have done. Hindsight's 2020. But the point being, it's been ignored. I mean, there was, and this is not Trump, but like Congress was like making plans to like have some kind of response to it in like October. Meanwhile, people are literally dying because they don't have electricity, they don't have diesel to run the generators, everything's flooded. I mean, it's a disaster. And then did you see Trump's tweets when he finally did tweet about it?
A little bit.
Oh God, they were bad.
I know that he, you know, he kind of bragged about it.
No, he blamed them. He was like, Florida and Texas are doing fine, but Puerto Rico sucks, so they're doing worse. And then he was like, they owe lots of money to Wall Street, and it's going to suck for Wall Street.
Oh, yeah, I did see that, yeah. You know, there's just so many tweets, it's hard to keep up with sometimes. Yeah.
His aides were trying to defend it by saying that he wasn't trying to, like, insult Puerto Rico. He was just trying to show off how much he knew about subject matter.
I see. Well, I do think, you know, there have been some unfair accusations made about Trump. Dan Pfeiffer, who used to work in the Obama administration, tweeted out that simply because Puerto Rico does not have any electoral votes, that Trump doesn't care about them. And then he deleted it because, I guess, there were people who actually debunked his claim.
Well, that's not even Trump-specific. I think there is a huge issue here in that we have an actual colony. We treat like a colony that doesn't have representation. I mean, at least in D.C. I mean, yeah, we don't have a vote, but, you know, if things suck here, guess who's going to have to endure it too? So it can't get too bad without someone being like, okay, fine, we got to take care of this.
And, you know, the Puerto Rican government is basically running out of default. And at least as far as I can remember, I don't think anyone in Washington has been pushing for them to get bailed out.
No, they've been in trouble for a while. Puerto Rico was already teetering. And this is, unless we take drastic action to actually treat like part of America, which it is, God, this is not... There's no good coming from this for a long time.
Now, it's no secret that the ladies know putting on good underwear in the morning is a key part of owning your day because it helps you feel confident, powerful, and ready to conquer the world. And MeUndies are some of the most comfortable underwear you will ever own. They're made from a sustainably sourced, naturally soft fabric that, get this, is 3 times softer than cotton, and they're super breathable. They've got tons of different colors and styles to fit whatever your preference is, boy shorts, bikinis, something for everybody. Tons of cute colors and styles to choose from, solids, patterns, brights, lace, one for every mood and every occasion. And once you feel MeUndies for yourself, you're going to love them. And that's a guarantee, an actual guarantee, because MeUndies comes with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. They guarantee you will love your undies or you get your money back. And right now, MeUndies has an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Get 20% off your first pair and free shipping. And MeUndies is so sure you're going to love their underwear. Again, they offer a 100% satisfaction guarantee. You order a pair, and if you don't love it, you get a full refund. This is a no-brainer to try. 20% off, free shipping, and 100% satisfaction guarantee. Really, what are you waiting for? So to get your 20% off, free shipping, and 100% satisfaction guarantee, get the best and softest underwear you will ever own. What you have to do is this. You go to MeUndies.com/45th. Once again, that's MeUndies.com/45th. And this is a limited time offer, so what are you waiting for? Start wearing the best underwear of your life. Go to MeUndies.com/45th right now.
So I want to hear what you have to say about Paul Manafort, because it seems like this might take a few minutes, that, and I really want to hear what you have to say.
It's blowing up too constantly now. I'm just doing this now because I thought, like, Manafort stuff's going to be kind of, like, heating up. I was like, okay, I'll give the background stuff on it. And now I'm like, shit, before the episode comes out, they're probably going to indict him already.
let me just check Twitter and make sure he was not already
indicted. Yeah,
like, seriously,
don't indict him, or don't publicly release any indictments yet. Just give it to this episode, it comes out.
Run it down. I don't see anything yet at the top of my feed, so I think you're good.
God. We have two people currently who were tied to Trump who are likely going to get indicted. That's Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor, and Paul Manafort, the campaign manager for, what, the middle of 2016 for Trump's campaign. And both of them are in a lot of trouble. And for similar, actually remarkably similar reasons, but they're not that similar in terms of character. Michael Flynn is kind of nutty and way over the place and does not cover his trail at all and is going to go down for, like, really stupid, obvious corruption. Manafort's been doing this game for a long time. He knows what he's doing, so he probably also knows that he's in a lot of deep shit right now. Do you know about Manafort's history, like, back in the GOP, back in the good old days, I guess?
No, go ahead and explain it to me and as well as for our audience.
Yeah, so he's been around forever, basically. I don't know how old he is, but he first came on the stage in 1976 when he was brought in to help Gerald Ford.
He's 68 years old.
Okay, yeah, so he's been around for a while.
Born in New Britain, Connecticut, like just a town over from where I grew up.
He was still pretty young then for the contested convention. But basically, I think that was the last time we had a contested convention, and it was his job to sort of wrangle all the delegates and make sure Ford actually, you know, got the votes. And since then, he has appeared just about every Republican presidential candidate's campaign in some form or another. He dealt with Reagan's campaigns, he managed the 88 and the 96 conventions, and his business partner, Rick Davis, was actually the campaign manager for McCain for 2008. Now, that also was the source of a lot of drama, not quite the same degree that Manafort's going to be, but when Davis was McCain's campaign manager, he worked for free. He did not take a salary for his work there, but he drew a lot of criticisms because of his foreign lobbying ties and his sort of like shady lobbying history in general. He also arranged for a sort of clandestine meeting, not clandestine, that's the wrong word, but for, you know, a discreet meeting with Oleg Deripaska, who is one of the major Russian oligarchs. And so Davis actually, there was a rumor, I'm sure we'll find out soon if it's true or not, that Deripaska helped buy a unit for Davis and Manafort in Trump Tower.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, seeing a little... This was during the 2016 campaign that you're saying?
No. It was back during McCain's campaign.
It's
just long term.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Just want to make sure we keep frame of reference. And
it's hard to do sometimes with Manafort because this guy's been everywhere.
So he got a residence in Trump Tower for this Russian oligarch, is what you're saying?
Well, and it's not determined where the money came from there yet. But one of the things Mueller's currently looking into is the massive real estate investments that Manafort has under various shell corporations, including this one. Anyway, Manafort kind of disappeared from U.S. politics for a while. He turned to being a foreign lobbyist, and the best way to describe his career, like, past couple decades, is like the fairy godmother to authoritarian strongmen, and he comes in, polishes them up, makes them look like populist figures, sort of smooths over their corruption, and then has them run divisive campaigns that exploit wedge issues and obtain electoral victories, and then usually end up in some kind of corruption scheme. For instance, he represented Ferdinand Marcos, which also links back to the Reagan campaign he was on, because there was apparently $57 million that Marcos had earmarked to donate to Reagan's campaigns in 84, but that never actually got resolved one way or another. Yeah, and he's also, you know, Mabuja was a client of his, but probably the most important client, at least for current day events, is Yanukovych, who is the head of, or was the president of Ukraine.
And he was president from when to when?
So he was prime minister, which is a lower office in Ukraine, and he ran in 2004, and he actually won, only it was a really fraudulent election, so their court overturned it. And that's when Manafort first came into the picture. He's in this runoff election for the second election, because the first one was too corrupt, and he came in kind of last minute and couldn't turn it around, and Yanukovych lost. And this was the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. So
we are now up to what, 2014 now?
Nope, 2004, 10 years back.
Okay. Sorry, there was another revolution that I remember in 2014. So
same people involved, also Manafort involved at that time too.
Okay.
And so, for instance, in 2006, a diplomatic cable that we have from WikiLeaks described Yanukovych's party, which is the Party of Regions. And the cable said, enjoying a lead in the polls since the fall 2005 Orange Team split, ex-Prime Minister Yanukovych's Party of Regions is working to change its image from that of a haven for mobsters into that of a legitimate political party. Tapping the deep pockets of Donetsk clan father Renat Akhmetov, I just butchered that, I'm sure, sorry. Regions has hired veteran K Street political help for its extreme makeover effort. According to the internet news site, Davis, Manafort, and Friedman is among the political consultants that have been hired to do the nipping and tucking. So, I mean, this nipping and tucking was basically lessons in how to teach Yanukovych to mimic empathy and to be more disciplined so he'd stop just saying crazy shit off the cuff. And he was kind of effective. I mean, he had apparently, Yanukovych started like yelling, I feel your pain, at his campaigns, rallies.
So, created him into a populist figure.
Mm-hmm.
And so he won his election.
In 2010, so finally, January 2010, he's up for election again, this time against Yulia Tymoshenko, and he nearly won against her in an election that, once again, was marked by widespread allegations of vote rigging. So he's now the president, thanks to Manafort's tutelage. And then in 2011, Yanukovych actually had his political opponent in the election locked up and sentenced to 7 years in prison. So... yeah, lock her up can actually happen sometimes.
Yeah, it really did.
And what happened, though, is that things were going well. He finally got this guy in power. It's all working out. But in 2014, Yanukovych refused to sign this agreement that would have brought Ukraine closer to Europe. Now, Yanukovych is like a pro-Russian, anti-NATO kind of guy. And this refusal sparked off another revolution, 2014 Ukrainian Revolution. Over 100 people were killed, protesters and police. It was violent. It ended up with Yanukovych fleeing in the middle of the night, and Russia helped, you know, swoop him up, pick him up, take him into exile in Moscow.
Okay, so that's where he has been since.
Ever since. And that same day, Putin began planning Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea. So that triggered the invasion and the stuff we're still dealing with today there. So yeah, Manafort didn't leave. I mean, obviously that was kind of a setback to have your dude sent into exile after winning the presidency. But he had other work going on in Europe. For instance... during this whole time, there were lots of other deals Manafort was involved in with other Russian oligarchs. Too many to get into right now. But again, our boy Oleg Deripaska appears again. Because Manafort did a lot of work with government officials, you know, wannabe strongman types. But he also had close working ties with, you can't call them private figures, but Russian oligarchs like Deripaska, who was the head of the world's second largest aluminum company. And he's a billionaire several, many times over. Again, in the WikiLeaks cables that were released in 06, he was described as among the 2 to 3 oligarchs Putin turns to on a regular basis, and a more or less permanent fixture on Putin's trips abroad. He's one of the ones that's pretty close to Putin. They work pretty well together, which is why in 2005, Manafort, and this is, again, right after Manafort started working for Yanukovych in Ukraine, Manafort wrote a memo in which he outlined his proposal to offer a great service that can refocus both internally and externally the policies of the Putin government. Manafort described a plan to influence politics, business, and news coverage in Europe and the U.S. that would promote Putin's interest and prevent future occurrences like events like the Orange Revolution, in which a pro-Russian leader was blocked from taking power. Manafort's memo just wrote, We are now of the belief that this model can greatly benefit the Putin government if employed at the correct levels with the appropriate commitment to success.
Now, so that was that cable or that memo, was that taken from WikiLeaks?
No, that one. So right now, AP has that memo. They haven't released it. We don't know the full details of what Manafort is proposing. We don't know what this model that he apparently was going to use to, you know, tilt the world stage in Russia's favor. But Manafort and Deripaska did end up in a deal in 2006.
Does that confirm, you know, closer ties between Manafort and Putin?
Well, it's not even as far as I know, there's nothing that directly links Manafort to Putin. But like Deripaska is basically Putin's mouthpiece, so it's not.
So it's like a third degree or second degree of separation, 2 degrees of separation.
But he was willing to promote Putin's interests, Putin government's interests, which includes the oligarchs' interests, are some of them. So anyway, that goes on. Up until fall of 2015, Manafort's still in the Ukraine. And then we get to March 2016. Trump was the front runner in the Republican primary, but there was talk that Republicans might, you know, find a spine and rebel against the incoming chaos and destruction of their party. Didn't happen. Turns out to be a false alarm. But because there was concern that there might be a coup at the convention, that's when Manafort appeared. He's the delegate whisperer. He's the one with experience in making sure the delegates do what they're supposed to do, which is vote for the guy who got the most votes. And we actually know as of last night, and this is on Wednesday that we're recording this, he sent in February, Manafort wrote to Trump with a proposal about why he should be brought into the campaign. He worked for free. He was anti-establishment, that kind of thing.
And there was nothing. What else did that say in them?
I don't know, because there's some stupid NBC, video release on it. They didn't release the actual memo.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was lame.
Why do they always do that?
Because they're lame. But it does confirm, of course, we know that Manafort was working for free. And then we know from various sources that on March 17th, Trump called him, made the offer. And Manafort said, if you can meet my conditions, I'm in. We don't know what those conditions were. I do find it intriguing, though, that 2 days later, Trump announces his foreign policy team and includes Carter Page, who is the kid who is way deep in the Russia stuff.
And also, yeah, so Carter Page, I recall, he said in an interview to Chris Hayes of MSNBC that...
Oh, God, I can't watch his interviews. They're so painful.
Or was it to Anderson Cooper? It was to one of... He gave an interview to one of these evening talk show hosts and basically said that he could not confirm nor deny that he met with the Russians in or around the Cleveland area during the GOP convention in July.
Oh, he totally did.
Yeah, so of course, like...
He went to Moscow in July to meet with him there.
Giving a non-denial means you pretty much did it.
Yeah.
For the most part. It was the weakest non-denial that he could give, which obviously leads you to believe that, yes, he in fact did meet with some Russians, and we don't know exactly who they were. But they may have been part of the Kremlin.
He's a screwy guy. Like, you read his letters, and he sounds like, I'm not trying to exaggerate here, he does sound like he might have some kind of mental imbalance.
That's certainly possible. And I think, was it Trump said that he never heard of the guy, or was it someone else?
Then why'd you name him a foreign policy advisor? Yeah. So who knows? But also, it's worth noting that Carter Page was, in fact, a Russian asset in 2013. He got involved in some oligarch scheme there. Long story, got picked up on a wiretap, was used as evidence in a case, and was also subject to a FISA warrant again in 2016. So he's a repeat player when it comes to, like, really dumb Russian conspiracies.
Easily one of the dumber players in the game at the moment. And Manafort, to his credit, he seems like a smart guy, but it seems like he handled this very poorly.
Manafort is for sure a smart guy, but he's also the dodgiest motherfucker that's been in U.S. politics in a long time, I suspect.
So where does this lead now? I know you have a lot more written up on this.
Fast forward to August 2016, and then an article comes out, New York Times, about the Black Ledger in Ukraine. Turns out the Party of Regions was slightly corrupt and had about $2 billion in cash of obscure origins that was being used to bribe people in the government to, you know, get their way. And Manafort's name shows up in that ledger many times, 22 times at least that we've seen, for a total of $12.7 million in payments. Although other sources have put the actual total number from all the ledgers at closer to $50 million. Now, it was pretty, like, basic level bribery stuff. As one Ukrainian reporter put it, lawmakers were being sold in bonds in the marketplace. It was primitive and artless, but involved big money. For instance, they show that the Party of Regions was bribing the chief of the Central Election Commission, a guy named Mikhailo Okhondovsky, and that he was, you know, in their pocket, essentially. And that's the head of the election commission in Ukraine. So these ledgers come out. They show that Manafort's getting all his money off the record. Manafort says, I didn't do that. That's not how I operate. No, it's a lie. Their books are a forgery. Didn't do it. Didn't happen. Fake news. And he's like, I only ever received wire funds, never cash. Which is true, because what seems to have happened is that the black ledgers were sort of the internal accounting for the Party of Regions. And it's a record of the various officials who are withdrawing cash and taking it to be laundered. So it's a record of the transactions before it gets to the laundering stage, before it went to Manafort. And as time went on, Manafort stopped saying it was forgery. And he started saying things like, through a spokesman, Maloney, who Mueller also interviewed, no one has produced any evidence that the payments were for anything other than legitimate political consulting that Paul was openly doing during this period. Maloney also claimed that the AP's report on this was all fake because Manafort received his money through wire transfers. And this is a contradiction from the news reports that talk about the ledger's cash payments. Not a contradiction. Again, this was just the cash stage before it got laundered and sent to Manafort. Yeah. So here's where it gets even dicier for Manafort and why he is screwed and going to get indicted like he's been saying.
Now, hold on. Before you get into that, I just want to know, what do you think he would get indicted for?
Money laundering is the, like, that one is kind of foreign conclusion.
That seems pretty straightforward right there. Would there be anything else?
I think very likely. You know, there's a lot of possibilities. Manafort's been a lot involved in a lot of dodgy stuff. Again, this guy's going around and he's a gun for hire to help unsavory types get elected in third world countries. But the money laundering is the straightforward one and it's pretty more or less black and white. Because let's go back to that $12.7 million that went to Manafort. On October 14th, 2009, the black ledgers show that someone in the Party of Regions took out $750,000 in cash. And on the line for, like, the purpose of the money, they wrote Manafort. Now, Manafort claims that all these entries, the 22 entries that, you know, have his name in them, that was all forgery, didn't happen, never happened.
Someone took it in his name, trying to frame him.
Well, it turns out someone had an invoice for that exact same day where the firm of Davis Manafort issued an invoice to a company called Neocom Systems Limited, which is a shell company in Belize. And it happened to be on the exact same date that that black ledger transfer happened for the exact same amount. Only Manafort's invoice claimed, and it was his, he signed it, the money was wired to his account in Alexandria. And he apparently sold 501 computers to this shell company in Belize for a purchase price of $750,000. Now, why is a political consultant selling computers in mass bulk to a fake company?
Are they confirmed to be a fake company?
I mean, it's also been involved in other money laundering schemes in Kyrgyzstan, so there's a lot going on that company was. But also, again, Neocom Systems has no other record. There's no actually indication of who owns it, who is behind it. The money itself came from Bishkek Asia Universal Bank and then was wired to the Manafort in Alexandria, Virginia. So again, and also, interestingly enough, if you look at that invoice, it lists the three types of computers. And if you look up where it came from, there's this obscure Ukrainian computer site that someone, at some point in 2009, copied and pasted the specs for three random computers and pasted them, typos and all, onto this invoice sheet. And every single computer was for sale for like $1,000 of Ukrainian currency, which is like maybe like $40 in US dollars, which is
so
weird.
Would not necessitate withdrawing $750,000 or purchasing something for $750,000.
And again, why? Because let's assume that this is a real thing. Manafort did for some reason buy 501 pretty high-end computers in Ukraine. Like, what reason would he have for that?
You got me. I have no idea.
I suspect it's just a stupid fake money laundering invoice, because that's what it looks like. But I guess it's possible there was, you know, botnet stuff going on back in that election in Ukraine. Maybe that's the source behind it. But given all the oddities in the invoice, more likely it's just a cover. It was, like, straight up money laundering. Manafort was right. The money got wired to him. He didn't get cash because Ukraine took that cash to Bishkek in Kyrgyzstan and put it in the bank there, and that bank wired it to Manafort. So he's kind of doomed on this issue. Like, it's pretty clear what happened.
So he's doomed on this issue. Mm-hmm. Now, does that necessarily mean that he did something similar in this election cycle, this past one?
Well,
or does it just open up the door for possibility?
It opens up a pretty direct door because there's more to it. And there's other stuff that Manafort's in trouble for. For instance, Manafort helped the Party of Regions hire U.S. lobbyists under a fake shell organization so they wouldn't have to register under the Foreign Agent Registration Act. And that was Manafort. According to people at the consultant groups, at a 2012 meeting, Manafort's partner, Gates, said that the role of like this fake nonprofit they were using was to supply money that couldn't be traced to the Ukrainian politicians involved. And if you look at the expense ledgers, this is really obscure, but if you go back and check what the FARA filings from these lobbyists say about what they were getting at that time and compare it to the black ledger amounts, it seems pretty strong correlation. The black ledgers were actually giving money out to the American lobbying groups through this front nonprofit called the European Center for Modern Ukraine. And again, more of a detail thing, but if you also look at the FARA filings for these American lobbying groups, guess who they're talking to? That same Central Election Commission official who they flew over to the U.S. to meet with U.S. politicians on the Party of Regions dime. Like, the Ukrainian bribery scandal was so overt, it's kind of ridiculous. It's the most blatant, no one gives a damn about anything kind of bribery they were doing.
Because they could get away with it. And now,
yeah. So there's a lot. Mueller has plenty to choose from.
Are you in need of great talent for your business, but you're short on time? Well, you don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools, smarter tools. And the smartest tool out there to find the right person for your position is ZipRecruiter. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. It puts its smart matching technology to work. They actively notify you of qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches without having to individually post on so many different job sites. And another reason that ZipRecruiter is different is because, unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. So no wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/45. Again, it's ZipRecruiter.com/45. And one more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/45. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Well, I happen to recall that the Russian scandal started taking place, like really started gaining steam in September. And he resigned, I recall, in August.
They were picking up steam, but there was pretty early on, there was like discomfort with it. Like when Trump went on in July and was like, Russia, if you're listening, release the hacked emails.
Right. But was he trying to blame Manafort for that? I can't recall as that being a reason why he resigned or was fired.
Well, I think he resigned because he knew how deep the shit was once those black ledgers came out. But he was trying to play it off as like it's an optics thing. Now, one interesting thing we have here is that Manafort's adult daughter ended up getting hacked by someone. And her text messages for like the past 4 years were leaked online. Which has a lot of interesting information. I mean, it's the daughter's view, so who knows if what Manafort was telling her was the truth. But based on what Manafort was telling her, he didn't really leave the campaign. According to the daughter, it was all optics and that he was still continuing by the scenes. And in fact, she claimed that he was responsible for hiring Bannon and Kelly and Conway to take over after he left.
I see. So it's kind of like, you know, when news broke that Sean Spicer resigned, he actually like stayed like another month.
Well, this is more like he actually, Manafort left right away, but never really left at all. And we've now learned that they are still on the phone, him and Trump, well into 2017. So
what do you think he has been doing for Trump since that announcement that he was no longer working with the campaign?
Well, I don't know, but I suspect people in the government do, because we now know that there was a FISA warrant on Manafort. It's Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Actually, it turns out that the government's been watching Manafort for a long time because it was really shady. So in 2014, they had a FISA warrant and they watched his activities in Ukraine. But then something happened. And what it appears to be is that, back up, the FISA warrant is a way that, I won't get into all the details now, but basically it was a way that they could listen in on these conversations that Manafort had because they had reason to believe that he was an agent of a foreign power. And this warrant lapsed, apparently, this is just a guess from everything we've seen, early 2016, due to lack of new information being obtained. For whatever reason, this warrant stopped getting new info. They either changed the methods they were communicating, something happened, and they closed it down because there's nothing coming in. And also, interesting to note, according to the daughter's text messages, Manafort's preferred way of talking in secret was to use a shared like Gmail account, and you'd write a draft email, never send it, and wait for the person to log in and check and see the draft.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know if the FISA was watching that, but if it wasn't, that could have been why they stopped getting info.
I mean, I've heard of that use of communicating before. I think I can't recall where I saw that.
Like a Bond movie?
No. It's this movie that Don Cheadle was in. I think it's called Traitor. Have you seen it?
No, but it sounds relevant.
No, it was a great movie. It was actually him infiltrating a terrorist cell. I mean, and he's Muslim in the film, and that one of the modes of communicating was basically writing an email, but sending it, saving it as a draft.
Well, maybe that's where Manafort learned how to do that.
Maybe, and it came out, it had to be like 2006, 2007.
Oh, so right around the time that, yeah, could be. What we do know, though, is that a second FISA warrant was taken out on Manafort. Again, we don't know when. We know it was not until late summer, because we know that there was a gap, like a brief few months when Manafort was not being monitored, and that was like during the June 6th meeting with the Russians and a few other meetings.
You know, there was a story that broke last week about Paul Manafort being wiretapped in Trump Tower, and that all
not
sudden,
in Trump Tower though. That part's never confirmed.
No, okay, so it wasn't in Trump Tower, but he was being wiretapped. Therefore, all of his conversations with Donald Trump were being wiretapped over the phone. And somehow
gave
basically Donald Trump vindication, and the conservative media played this up. I recall they played
it. But it was
up.
Wrong, totally wrong, because there was never any wiretaps on Trump Tower.
Right, and so there wasn't any wiretaps on Trump Tower, but it was basically like, oh, see, look, he was wiretapped, but really they were just wiretapping Paul Manafort this entire time.
And we don't even know if Trump was picked up. I mean, apparently Trump and him were still in close communication, which would suggest that they may have picked Trump up on those wiretaps. But we don't know that. That's just guessing from the fact that Manafort was wiretapped and Trump kept calling him. So yeah, that's whatever they picked up in that warrant, I suspect. Well, we know it didn't end there because Mueller's investigation has really heated up on Manafort. He's been subpoenaing all his financial records. He's been trying to get records from Cyprus where all the secret bank accounts were to find out more. And they even did like a no-knock warrant on his house.
Right. It was a little bit of a raid.
A pre-dawn raid where they picked the lock.
Raid.
Yeah.
And it was like 4 or 5 in the morning, wasn't it?
It was like, I think they'd have to do it in later hours. I think it was like 6 or something. But still, it's a big deal to, that's not the norm. That's not how you usually do things in white collar crime. It means that things were convincing enough to get a judge to sign off on this. That not just the probable cause, but probable cause that Manafort would try and hide evidence. And they also raided a storage facility he owned. But anyway, this is where it all comes back to the beginning. Deripaska makes a reappearance. Now, Manafort wasn't paid for his work as a campaign manager, but that doesn't mean he wasn't looking to get paid. Because right after he was chosen as campaign manager, he started talking to his Ukrainian business associates, and they were talking about how can they use Manafort's new position as campaign manager to get whole, i.e. to get paid from Ukraine. Because based on, again, the daughter's text messages, Ukraine stopped paying Manafort in 2015. I guess, their dude got exiled to Russia, so things kind of fell apart. They lost their money. And apparently Manafort was really hurting. So he's now campaign manager of a presidential candidate's campaign, and he's like, let's use this to get the money I'm owed. And that, have you heard about the July 7th email?
I did not, please. I'd like to hear it.
It's where he was writing to Deripaska and saying, hey, we can get you briefings on the state of the Trump campaign. Let us know. This is the guy in 2005 Manafort wrote to with his grand plan, how he can greatly help Putin's government with this model of securing election wins for pro-Russian forces and foreign nations.
So, man, that's just so much to rack your brain around here.
I mean, if you're going to find a guy who would do a conspiracy to, like, help a pro-Russian candidate win, like, why not have it be the guy that already did that, literally?
I mean, like, there's just so much that's happened. And this is, you explaining it in the last, like, 25 minutes, I'm still, like, trying to grasp what happened, and I don't know.
It's hard. It's a really confusing, and there, like, he's, Manafort is good. He's hidden his trail. That's how he's kept active this whole time. And it is hard to follow what matters, what doesn't, because Manafort's done a lot of shady things that are probably irrelevant. But his relationship with the Russian oligarchs has been consistent, and it's not just Deripaska. There's other guys, like Firtash is a whole other story, well, related story, that Manafort's also involved with money laundering there. Basically, it's a whole lot of money laundering and a whole lot of helping pro-Russian people get power in other states.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, he's probably going to get indicted. He expects to be indicted.
Yeah, and Mueller said he's going to indict him.
Mueller said he's going to indict him. So the only question is, will they have leverage to get anybody else in the Trump campaign or who worked in the Trump campaign or even Donald Trump himself? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, the reason he's going after Flynn and Manafort is because they are completely screwed on this. They're very big fish in normal circumstances, but they're not the real fish here. They're trying to get someone to flip on Trump.
Right. That's what I'm saying is that would they have enough leverage to try to get them to sing?
They got two. That's the thing. Manafort and Flynn now are rivals. If it was just Manafort or just Flynn, Trump would be sitting pretty. Not pretty. It'd be pretty bad still. But he would have a stronger chance. But now it's not just a matter of one of these, you know, Russian agents standing strong and not turning. They have to fear that the other one's going to turn. Because if there's any deal made, it's going to be like first past the post kind of deal. Like, Flynn, you want this, come forward now. Manafort, you want it, come forward now. If you're second in the door, you ain't getting nothing.
Interesting.
So that really doubles the stakes down for them. And Flynn made the mistake of getting his son involved.
Yeah, I did see that.
So he has to reckon with, like, am I going to stay loyal to Trump and see my son go to prison potentially? Or am I going to flip? And Flynn's made a lot of comments that, like, sound way too cozy. Who knows? But I suspect he may have. If anyone's flipped, it's him. I don't think Manafort has. Manafort is trying to dodge us still.
Well, it sounds like a good note to end on, unless you got more.
There will always be more. And I'm sure by the time this comes out, there'll be new Manafort revelations. And I think Americans are going to get a crash course in money laundering. It's probably a good thing Ozark came out now. Although Ozark's doing it all wrong, it bugs me.
I'm going to read up the Wikipedia page on money laundering so I could become an expert.
Yeah. I mean, I think Manafort should get a new job teaching it because he's has some serious experience in that. And of course, there's in a later episode, I'll try and get more into what Manafort's actually doing that looks like money laundering. But that's the background of who all the players are, what positions are, and why it's really not that hard to imagine that Manafort might use the same Russian connections he's been using the past decade to help someone in an election, which is something he's done before.
Wow. Well, I appreciate learning all of that, Susan. Thank you for doing your research.
So,
you want to take us out of here?
Well, that is it. Thank you for listening to the 45th podcast. We'll be back next week with a new episode, and I'll not be here, but Robbie will be here to take over for any new Russia amazing info that comes out. And I'll see you then.
Big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible, and I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products, and thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com, and guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.